Hi, I'm Pooja Disha Bharwani, founder and chief storyteller at What's the Story, a boutique communications consultancy based in Singapore. I love hearing, telling, and writing stories for individuals and businesses.
And my name is Kevin McSpadden. I'm the editor at E27. We are a media company covering startups and what they are up to in Southeast Asia.
On The Story of You, we want to offer a human and real conversation on how people succeed and overcome difficulties in the 21st century. Technology has changed the way we work and the ability for us to do things.
In this podcast, we bring you stories from successful individuals in Asia in a dynamic, engaging, and thought-provoking way.
Good morning and welcome to episode 4 of The Story of You. Today we have Jay Shah, founder and CEO of OpenDNA. OpenDNA is an artificial intelligence company. I think I will let Jay explain what they do.
OpenDNA's AI platform enables brands to personalize marketing in real time by providing them with actionable information on their customers better than Facebook and Google. We're an artificial intelligence company. We built our own neural network that kind of learns on its own. We've used machine learning to self-improve our algorithms, and we've built our own visual recognition and natural language processing system to be able to train computer models to better understand human language.
So what does that look like to the layman?
You mean what? Sorry, go
on. No, when you ask the question. I'm in this world,
no,
so I understand
man, right?
It.
Like right. Yeah. What you said is so
how would you explain it to a taxi
technique.
Driver?
So, yeah, you know, give us stages of different types of AI. I mean, you're obviously, this is a very advanced sort of stage.
So let's look at it. Let's look at AI as a journey. There are many different levels of artificial intelligence. And I get asked the question, does your technology allow businesses to drive their own cars? And I said, no, that's a different type of technology being used. But so there's many forms of AI. AI is an amalgamation of a number of different technologies working together. In our situation, for example, I'll give you an explanation of AI. From a non-technical element, imagine a baby has just come into the world, has absolutely no knowledge of anything apart, you know, it's taking its first breath and it started to cry. And so you got to start with the basic rules as the baby starts getting a little older. So you start seeing yes, no, yes, no. So the basic rules. And then as the baby gets a little older and is not able to sit and you're able to feed it, now you start with a little bit more complex rules, such as if you eat your greens, you get to play, you know, you have your dessert. If you're good, you get to play with your toys. And then imagine that baby becoming a toddler. Now, this is the evolution within the artificial intelligence as well. You start with basic rules, then you create smart rules, and then you create interdependencies between the rule systems, which is where the baby is now sitting at the table and you're trying to give it different things. Like if you eat your greens, you get to eat dessert and so forth. But imagine the baby now evolves and becomes a toddler. At a toddler stage, you would consider this in an AI or a technical element, supervised learning. So now as a parent, instead of you constantly holding your baby, you're letting that baby roam around. But you're still watching that little child, making sure that the child doesn't actually push a finger or put a finger in something that's dangerous, like a socket. So if that was to happen or was about to happen, you as a parent would constantly, you know, you would jump in and you would teach the child. Mm. Now that's supervised learning. So every now and then on a growth of an artificial intelligence platform, you're going to get to a state where information, the rules are all running there, that you've got different sequences running, and every now and then they might be an anomaly and an alert, and in which case you have to go in and train the computer model to better understand what it just, you know, where it kind of went wrong. But imagine that evolving even further. Now the child has become a teenager, and as a teenager you don't have much of a say as a parent anymore. They're self-learning. They're on their own.
Scared of.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's what everybody's afraid of, right? So.
Well, that's absolutely. That's what people are afraid of. But if you think about everything that's happened in the world since the time of the Industrial Revolution, technology has always helped businesses, helped people do their jobs better. And yes, there are certain jobs that will be made redundant by bringing in artificial intelligence. I mean, that's going to happen. It's happened in every industry, and every single time there is a big leap in technology, it's happened. But that doesn't mean that those people will completely lose their job. They just need to skill in a different, you know, they need to have a different skill set.
Where do you think we are on the AI life cycle?
It's in the very early stages.
Are we a toddler yet?
So we're toddler?
Oh, no. So there are a lot of self-learning environments. So in terms of the technologies, they're very advanced. But in terms of the technology uptake by companies, it's slow at present. You get a lot of large corporations that think that they could build their own solutions, and they've never had experience in building artificial intelligence platforms, simply because the understanding of AI isn't there. They think by building a rules-based environment, by complex rules, they think that that's AI. It's not. It's more like big data. And the biggest problem with big data analytics is down to the limitation of the mindset of the person looking at big data. And so if big corporations and the guys behind it, technical departments, haven't done this, they're gonna struggle a lot. And to think that every company is gonna be able to build their own AI solutions is kind of crazy as well. I think the demand for artificial intelligence developers over the next few years is about 2 to 3 million people are needed to be able to code in this environment. Currently, I think there are only about 30,000 people in the world that actually can code in AI environments. So you don't have enough people and enough skill sets to be able to, for the demand that's coming in AI. So what's happening is you've got companies such as ourselves that are building solutions that allows any other company who don't have the skill set, who don't have the know-how, how to actually develop their own solutions to be able to implement our product much easily.
So let's just go back to your product, and it's very much about, like you say, coming up with a persona, a very detailed avatar of the user. So that would entail the businesses that use your software to give you their user data, and then you analyze it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, companies have said, why would we use any sort of AI platform, external system? Because our data is so important to us. We know so much about our users. So, in fact, I'm not going to name the name of the organization, but it's one of the, you know, very, very large mobile operator. Basically, their marketing, head of marketing, they say, look, our data is so important to us. We know exactly what our users want. Why would we plug in an external environment? And I said, well, do you send out newsletters? And she says, yes. I said, what's your unsubscribe rate? She goes, about 0.25%. I said, so that's pretty good. But tell me why. She says, what do you mean why? I said, well, tell me why you're getting a 0.25%. She says, well, but I thought you just said it's a good percentage. I said, yes, it's a good percentage, but let's move it away from the statistical structure. And I said, okay, let me give you another scenario. You go home, you have an email address, a personal email address, and she says, yes. I said, do you receive newsletters? And she says, yes. I said, do you read every single newsletter that you receive? And she says, no. I said, do you unsubscribe? She says, yes. I said, why? Well, I don't get all the time relevant stuff. So now think of yourself back in the brand environment. Don't you think that you've actually just ticked off your customers by sending them irrelevant information, and they've just told you that they never want to hear from you again?
Mm. I said, that's extreme, but what I mean is, like, the human mind and mood can change. You're in a certain phase, you're in a certain period, there are different, so you can't, like, this is my thing, like, how individualistic a profile can you be, and then how do you apply that? They have, I'm sure a lot of these big publishing companies already have software that creates simple diagnostic tools, right?
Analytics.
So how does this take it further, and how can it be applied?
Absolutely. So I'm going to give you the output value that we are industry agnostic. We can apply this technology across various different industry sectors. It's all about understanding the single user. But let's look at it from a publishing perspective. From a publisher's perspective, you want to increase your page views. You want to increase your engagements. Because if you can do that, then you're going to be able to get people spending more time in your platform, and then you can show them more content. If you show them more content, if you've got advertising in there, you're going to make more money. It's a very simple, formula. Now, in that environment, a publisher would do two things. Would insert our application or JavaScript onto their site or mobile application. They would send us a feed of all of their content. We would then analyze their content. And based on how the user is interacting with that content, based on the time of the day, based on the location of that user, based on the weather patterns, we're then able to build a very unique psychographic map of this specific user. So the next time the user comes into an environment, they're getting the most personalized experience ever. And so they end up spending more time. We tested this technology. We built a news aggregator. And typical news aggregators, if you're a good one, you're going to get about 2, 3, 4 minutes of average session time. And then the user is going to go onto some other app, or he's going to go onto some other site. Our news aggregator, we've seen scenarios of up to 18 minutes of engagement time, because every single time the person comes in, they're seeing the most personalized experience. Now we get asked, he says, how is your technology so different to everybody else out there? I mean, surely there are a lot of companies doing stuff. I said, absolutely. But you come up with a concept of, you want to build a system that truly understands the user. So that system can then allow a single user to experience the internet in a more personal way, to bring the internet of me concept. So how do you do this? So basically I looked at this and I said, we cannot apply, predefined statistical structures that other people have sort of defined in grouped scenarios. So basically here we are, three of us. And we have an interest. We like technology. We like publishing. We like radio interviews. So we have a number of interests. Doesn't mean we're going to all eat pizza for lunch and Thai food for dinner.
Yeah.
So putting a bucket doesn't work. So I wanted to build a system that truly understood the single user. But more importantly, that system needed to understand the psychology of how people make decisions.
How do a publishing company, for example, how would they adapt to the information you're providing? I kind of understand that getting all this user information, and as someone on the publishing side, it's nice to know, but I don't 100% think it would impact our website too much, because once we start to try to tailor to every individual user, you're suddenly overworked, for lack of a better word.
Well, you're right. So by providing a lot of information that's not actionable, you're going to get stuck in those environments. With OpenDNA, it not only provides you with this information, but allows the publisher to fully automate the entire experience for that specific user. So you could have a million customers or a million readers on your environment. Every single user will have the most unique experience. And the publishers, from the publisher side of things, they don't have to do anything. Mm. They plug in our JavaScript, they build a widget, and that widget actually personalizes all the news content for that specific user based on their latest psychographic profile.
So if E27 got OpenDNA, we were one of your clients, every time someone would hit the web, if I went to the website, it would be different than if Pooja went to the website.
Absolutely.
It would look completely different based on what...
Depending on how they've structured, absolutely. Okay. From the content perspective, it'll look completely different to each individual. And from a data privacy perspective, which is what everybody's kind of looking at right now and kind of scared, because what does it mean, you know? The user owning their data, the user controlling their information, the user being able to tell you to switch on and switch off the tracking system. What does it really mean? And surely I'm not a publisher that actually does any business in Europe, so I should be away from it. But it's not. It's down to the EU national. The moment the EU national comes onto your site, you're bound by these data regulations. Now, on a data privacy perspective, from OpenDNA's side of things, once you plug in, yes, we collect a lot of information, but the user owns the data.
Mm.
The user has complete access to the information. The user gets to control this information, gets to see it, gets to export it, gets to basically tell the publisher, don't follow me or follow me, back and forth. They can keep toggling back and forth. And by doing this, they can see a personalized experience or a crappy experience. So putting the entire control back into the user's seat and letting them become the driver. And there's a huge benefit here. Because then the user is telling you, send me more of this information, send me less of that.
And you would have to prove, at least especially in Singapore, that this is true, because Singapore has fairly regulated privacy data protection laws.
Absolutely.
Not famous for it, but how did you get over that hurdle or work around it in the beginning?
Because we don't own the data. So the data is owned by the user. The data is viewable by the user. The data is completely controlled by the user.
And in exchange for that data, right now they're getting a personalized internet experience.
Correct.
Okay. Do you mind explaining a non-publishing use case? I understand the publishing in my head, but now I'm curious, so I'm trying to think, what if I was running an e-commerce site or a fitness app?
All right, let's take a fitness application. So fitness application, this guy has just developed a great application with 101 exercises. And so now as a consumer, as if you've looked at the way human beings are evolving, our attention spans are actually decreasing as we go along year by year. In fact, there was a study done that the average attention span for a human being today is 8 seconds.
Mm.
The average attention span for a goldfish is 9 seconds. So it looks like goldfish are smarter in this sense. But
I wrote an article on that study 3.5 years ago, and I still get like feedback from it.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, in fact, 2012, the average attention span for human beings was 12 seconds. So it's actually gone down. But in that environment, imagine if you're going into the fitness app. So instead of showing you 101 exercises, why doesn't it show you the ones that you actually want to look at? So if you're looking at a weight loss program or you're looking at bulking up or something, then show you the sequence of exercises that actually meet those requirements straight away. So as soon as you go into the app, you get the most personalized experience as opposed to, oh, I go to look at 101 exercises and figure out what I'm going to do here.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I usually look at 101 exercises and do random stuff
and then
for
you
an
waste
hour.
Time
and you waste
looking
time. Absolutely.
And not having no results. But so you talk about this personalization, we understand now how you apply it, how it works for publishers and non-publishers. What are the conversion rates? Bottom line, now you've had clients in Australia, you've been around for a few years. What have you seen in terms of results?
So we built the technology in 2014 as a prototype. 2015, we built it for scale. The core engine was built, but the commercial angle wasn't. So we needed to actually get that further. So we started working on the API and the software development kit, which is the application programming interface and the software development kit to allow any business to be able to bolt on their and build solutions. We took the company public in 2016, and then we had the cash that we needed to be able to build the team, to be able to get the product to commercial readiness. It was the end of last year, and we did that. And now we have customers signing up onto our environment. Where I can't tell you the companies that we're in discussions with, but I can tell you the industry sectors, telecommunications, so mobile operators, looking to use OpenDNA to predict subscriber behavior so they can actually predict when a subscriber requires customer services so they can proactively interact with that customer and reduce churn. You got internet service providers to be able to understand browsing ability for users, so be able to figure out how to optimize their network. We've got e-commerce companies that want to be able to predict what type of product sequences or product selections that users want to see. So we have actually got a company in Australia that signed a deal with OpenDNA. And one of the first things that they did was asked us to build them a drinks library. For cocktail recipes, for all sorts of different drinks and things like that. But it's not just recipes. It was, you know, talking about wineries, talking about beer, the manufacturing of beer, just everything. So based on how the user is going to be interacting with this content, they're going to be able to build a profile. So yes, you like wine, but not just that you like red or white wine. Let's go a little bit more detailed. You like Sauvignon Blanc, you like it from New Zealand and Australia and the French regions. You don't actually like the Sauvignon Blanc from any other region. So it kind of learns all of these things. So imagine this information now being pushed back to the procurement department, because then they can now use this to be able to predict exactly what type of products that people are going to be buying next, making better procurement decisions.
Mm, yeah.
You know, I had read somewhere that, you know, a consumer's data in a year is worth about 400, 500. What is, like, tell me about how that figure comes about, and what is a consumer's data actually worth?
Well, this is an interesting thing. A typical consumer has no idea that their data is actually valuable, very, very valuable.
Yeah. And I think we're starting to get there now. It seems like people,
Facebook
is
driving. They're paying for our attention.
Correct.
Know, like everything, yeah, it's moving towards that.
Correct. But from the user's perspective, they're giving away their data, but they're not getting anything back. They're still getting irrelevant advertising. You buy an airline ticket, the airline starts hounding you for months after you bought the airline ticket, giving you newsletters about the same special offer for that same destination you just purchased. E-commerce sites, you buy a product, you go back to the e-commerce homepage, and they're going to show you similar products to purchase. You know, this whole irrelevant experience is going to hopefully die away. But, you know, in terms of the value for a user, if you look at the average revenue for example, Facebook makes on a single user, I think it's about $250.
Wow.
So each user would be worth $250 to Facebook. If it's Twitter, I'm just going to take a couple of figures, let's say $80. If you look at Google might look at you and thinking you're worth $180 to them. And so if you start looking at every single platform that you're interacting with, and they're using your information to be able to show you advertising, and they make money through this, that's where, you know, that's how your data is sort of, you can say that that's the revenues you're generating for these corporations. You bundle that up together, I believe you'll probably get to $5,000 or $10,000 per user.
Wow.
And some influencers, of course, will be worth a lot more. Absolutely. Absolutely. Your data is worth so much, but users don't have the ability to be able to, you know, to monetize
it. Do you think we should be getting paid for our data?
That's something that there's a platform we're looking at right now. From OpenDNA's perspective, be giving control back to the user, that there's a possibility. But there have been models like that in the past, and it's very difficult to police. From our perspective, because we're putting everything in the hands of the user, you know, hopefully we'll be able to come up with a solution that actually does work.
I want to ask about the IPO strategy, and it sounds like you were fairly early. Like, and when people think of IPO, they think of $500 million listings, and it sounds like you did it as something of a fundraising strategy. I know Australia is known for being not loose, that's the wrong word. Australia is known for being like you can't just list in Hong Kong the same way you can in Australia.
No, the compliance checks are really, really strict. Well, back in when we developed this in 2014 and 15, venture capitalists at that moment had no real idea about artificial intelligence. So when an AI company came about, they were trying to pigeonhole it into an understanding that they're... So at that time, it was more like, wow, you guys have a great technology. Can you guys actually just become a content publisher? and create a personalized news aggregator kind of thing. Because back then, there was funding news aggregators left, right, and center.
Yeah.
Until Apple News came up, and everybody thought that Apple News was going to kill the entire, you know, aggregation market, but it didn't. It, you know.
Not a huge fan of Apple News.
No, no.
I don't
use it either.
A lot of, I mean, yeah.
It hasn't given what it promised. Yeah. And then, about 6-8 months later, I went back to the venture capital community, and now it was, oh, can we use your technology to personalize advertising? I said, yes. I said, oh, so could you turn into an ad tech company? And so each time I was trying to be able to being pushed into one direction or the other. At that moment, I thought, no, I've got a bigger vision here.
Yeah.
You know, the company's got a bigger vision and a lot more potential for with our technology. We need to be able to see where else can we raise the capital from people that would probably understand this. And so one of my investors was in Sydney, and she basically said, why don't you take a look at the Australian Securities Exchange? So not being to Australia ever in my life, the first time I stepped foot was in March 2016. I met a whole bunch of different people, which included our current board, that within meeting them, a month and a half later, we raised first $1.5 million. And then we started working towards a full IPO. One of the things that I didn't want to do is do a reverse listing into another mining shell.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah. So, you get a lot of skeletons in the closet, which we wanted to avoid. So we ended up doing a full IPO. And full IPO, when you're not revenue generating, we got 7 people in the company at the time. It's quite a challenge. I think I spent 320 nights in a hotel, 96 flights around the world, 65. I mean, it's just crazy in 2016. But we succeeded. We raised $8 million on the market. And that allowed us to build a team. So we're now 25 people in the company with offices in South Africa, Australia, and in Singapore. We have a team of machine learning, data science guys, UX fellows, quality assurance testers. We've got finance team. We've got business development. We've got a team now to be able to commercialize this product. So one of the things that the IPO did do for us was allowed us to bring in enough capital to be able to build out this vision.
You have a history. You have a serial entrepreneurial history. We can go into that in a little bit, but I wanted to ask, What's it like running a company, especially from quite the beginning stages, that's a public company versus building your own private enterprise and doing it the more traditional way?
It's very different. There are so many rules and regulations you got to stick to. At such early stage, every single deal that you sign is market sensitive. So you have to do an announcement. You've got to announce it to the market and so forth. Which, in a startup world, you could sign very small contracts and it didn't really matter. You just carried on with your business. But if you think about the sequence of activities, the moment you sign a contract in a public company, especially at such an early stage, we've got to put a market announcement together and then we've got to push it out. And so we got all these spots, checks and stuff and balances that have to be put in place. What you can say, what you cannot say. So then you've got all the regulatory stuff that every quarter, you've got the quarterly reports, you've got the audits, you've got the accounts, you've got the annual reports, you've got the AGM, I mean, you name it. There's a lot of back office compliance things that have to fall into place. And then you've got to deal with a lot of brokers.
That's
always an interesting exercise.
Especially if you want to take a risk. Like startups usually take significant risks. But you're a public company that's still a startup.
Yes, there are advantages and there are disadvantages. The biggest advantage, well, one, being a public listed company, we get noticed. You can get journalists in, right?
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And
they take you seriously.
They take you seriously. Companies will take a look at you. And the moment you say you did a full IPO, they all get intrigued and they really want to know more about your business. And the fact that you were able to do it means that there's something there. The other thing that if you wanted to buy companies, private entity, it'd be kind of difficult to do script deals or just give share allocations and say, okay, I'm just going to give you X amount of shares in my organization. You're a private company. We have no idea what that's worth. In a public company, your stock is a value. It's always traded on the market. Now, it doesn't mean that it's the right value because, again, it depends on how it gets traded, but there is a value.
Mm.
And so you could actually end up doing script deals to purchase companies. So there's a lot more stuff that you can actually do as a public company that you cannot do as a private company. But again, it does somehow sometimes hold you back.
And about the whole, like you said, people look at you differently, they take you seriously. You've come into this new market in Southeast Asia. Has that actually helped when you tell people and how much has that brought you forward in this new market?
Well, it got us, so I've been having a lot of speaking engagements and keynote talks here in Singapore at various different conferences. So they kind of, and you get a lot of these invites coming through. Opening doors with larger corporations becomes a little easier because now everything, you're open book, you're transparent, all your accounts, everything's online. So that it does help with larger corporations. But Singapore was a very strategic move for us. So yes, we're listed in Australia, but a massive market for our technology and where we're going is, you know, is Asia. Yes, it's the United States as well, but I didn't get the funding from venture capitalists there. So, and in fact, I did actually go back to some of these venture capitalists after we raised towards the IPO stage, and they said, you're a bit too late for us. So before it was
weird.
A bit too late, it's kind of weird. But so Asia, Singapore is the door into all of Asia. It's very, very stable. And, you know, they take IP protection very, very strongly. So we're in discussions with the Economic Development Board, for example, that all future patents will be filed by the Singapore entity. And so we want to build out the company out here, bring on board new team members over here. So this becomes the headquarters, and we start really building it out from this element. Market management perspective, sitting here, it's the same time zone as Perth, 3 hours prior to Sydney. It's a single flight to any of the locations that we actually need to do business in. It's one flight. So it's the best position for us to be located.
I want to ask you about your serial entrepreneur history. Now, you started 6 or 7 companies, you mentioned. You grew up in Nairobi, Kenya. You traveled around the whole world. What interesting perspectives do you have? Maybe first let's do the entrepreneurial thing. You, off record, you were saying it's like a kind of like a, almost an itch that always has to be scratched. I was joking that if I made a success, I would quit now because I'd already won. And you said, nope, I kept getting back in. What do you think that's about?
It's not always a hunky-dory pleasant journey. It's, you know, there's certain times you get knocked down, and you get knocked down pretty badly. I started my first software company when I was at university. And before finishing university, I raised £1.8 million and launched the company in London, New York, and Silicon Valley. We did very well for 1999 and 2000 in terms of sales growth. I was interviewed in all sorts of different radio stations, newspapers. We won awards for our product. But then the dot-com bubble burst. We were not a dot-com company. We were a software business, but yet we got hit pretty badly.
Okay.
So you can imagine from a student's perspective, you went from a broke student to making good money, and then all of a sudden went back again down. So that was an interesting exercise.
And you're like 25, so.
I was 22 or 23 or something. Yeah,
so
and it was quite an experience actually. You know, you do a lot of things, you learn, and you build up a lot of relationships. That was one of the good things. But my parents are very entrepreneurial. So 2 weeks after the whole thing changed and the dot-com bubble burst, and they said, okay, what are you doing next? And I said, this thing happened. I said, yeah, get out of it. Now get into the next mode. And they were especially one of my biggest backers in the company as well.
You've worked with many cultures in many countries.
Yeah.
And what do you think is, like you said, you know, this is the mistake that everybody's making. Is it really all universal, or is it like depending on the environment and, you know, what is that one key thing that people keep doing wrong?
Some of the things. One is bad management of cash flow. You know, the thing that everybody seriously always gets stuck on is, you know, the field of dreams concept, right? You build and they all come.
Yeah.
So a lot of the people start building applications and solutions, and they keep building, and eventually thinking that someone's going to come and buy them. And unfortunately, it's not all the time that happens. Sometimes the other companies actually get very lucky and they get acquired for a crazy amount of money. And that becomes an example that everybody wants to strive towards. But it doesn't always work that way. Whatever business plan you put together, you have to put a massive risk factor. So you make your plans on a very, very conservative model. But even that conservative model, make sure that you think that you may even not hit 50% of that.
And you can still survive.
And you should be able to still survive. So, because you never know how things progress. I mean, I remember when we launched our mobile operator, you know, it was an amazing product. We were going across Europe, and Europe was so expensive to make calls. All of a sudden, in 2007, July, the EU commissioner, forced every single operator in Europe to bring down their prices on roaming.
So suddenly you didn't have
it
a...
It was not relevant. Anymore.
Exactly. So immediately, overnight, you became an irrelevant solution in Europe.
Oh,
so
man.
We then had to pivot and go into other markets, you know, Southeast Asia, Africa, Russia, and stuff like that, to be able to sell our products. But you had to be able to move very, very quickly, because you just never know where that left curveball is going to hit you.
You're connected to Kenya with your family. Do you have any interesting insights in the startup scene over in Nairobi? I never really get an opportunity to ask someone who actually understands it.
Well, there's a lot that's going on. So Kenya has actually seen a boom over the last 15 years. There's a lot of young entrepreneurs coming together. They're bringing in funds even from individuals that are really, really serious about doing certain things. So they got a group of guys coming together and each one pitches money towards building solutions. And it's in a massive, massive boom in education technology. In fact, I remember reading about a rural school. And this is where, you know, where basically they don't even have buildings to teach their kids. Mm. They've got huts. And a school like that were able to send push notification, like SMS messages, to parents when the child didn't turn up to school, mm. or the child's results were actually sent out. And they're using technology, and there are companies that have built platforms to allow these sort of mechanics to happen. But yes, there is a massive boom in entrepreneurship in Kenya at the moment. And there's a lot of external investors looking to come into Kenya and investing quite a lot into that sector. A lot of venture capital funds, a lot of institutions. So Kenya is a big hotbed right now.
Thanks, Jay. I could talk about this forever, yeah. But we've hit the limit on our listeners. You're an interesting conversation. We didn't even touch into your global travels as much as I hoped, but I think I could make this a 2-hour podcast if I wanted to. So
thank you so much, Jay. Some great advice and very interesting what you're trying to do with OpenDNA.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. And guys, look, I have sometimes an open door policy. So find me on LinkedIn and you want to connect. Please go ahead and do so, but tell me what you're connecting about rather than trying to sell me anything. I do like to have conversations every now and then with startups. And so, yeah, do feel free to reach out.